Well, Shalom, Hadavarnix. Welcome to Hadavar Messianic Ministries and our School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the prophet Ezekiel, the 2022 edition. We're now in session 9, and we're beginning session 9 in chapter 7, verse 1. So let's review session 8 quickly. Now, in session 8, I recommended some resources for you, Future Israel by Barry Horner. These resources dealt with replacement theology, supersessionism. So Barry Horner's done a great job dealing with the future of Israel. And then, of course, I also recommend Dr. Fruchtenbaum's work. These are inexpensive Messianic Bible studies that are very helpful. The Modern State of Israel in Bible Prophecy, the Messianic Kingdom, and Israel in the Messianic Kingdom, to show you how literal and real the future for Israel is. Now, if you have a little more generous budget, then pick up Israelology, The Missing Link in Systematic Theology. This book will explain to you everything the Bible has to say about Israel, past, present, and future. It's a great book. And another book that's highly, highly recommended is Footsteps in the Messiah, A Study in the Sequence of Prophetic Events, again by Dr. Fruchtenbaum. This is the best book on eschatology, Revelation, that I have read. I've read a lot of books by a lot of different guys, and I think I said this before, I always keep going back to Arnold's work. I always keep going back to this book because he's the most exhaustive, most conservative. He's consistent. He's conservative. And he's very, very consistent with all the prophecies. So I recommend this highly. Well, we saw last session how the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem. They finally breached the walls in the north, and then Zedekiah and his troops, when they saw the Babylonians enter Jerusalem, made their hasty retreat to the south. And here is that retreat to the south, this view of the city. They headed down the Kidron Valley. Their goal was the plains of Jericho, the Arabah, and so they headed to the east, and the Babylonian army was in hot pursuit, but they captured Zedekiah. The Babylonians captured Zedekiah on the plains of Jericho and then took him north to Riblah, where Nebuchadnezzar had his headquarters. And, of course, Riblah is quite a ways north of Jerusalem. There at Riblah, Nebuchadnezzar punished Zedekiah. There, I got it. He published Zedekiah, and then the deportees were taken over the top of the Fertile Crescent down into this country of Babylonia, near to the capital city of Babylon, somewhere in that area. Then we moved into chapter 6, verse 1, and we saw that God issued judgments on the mountains of Israel. Now, why the mountains of Israel? Because it was on the mountains and the hills and the water courses and the valleys, everywhere, that idolatry was practiced. Wherever you looked in a scene like this, you would be sure to see the smoke rising from incense and sacrifices in every location. And then God said, they will know that I am the Lord when they experience destruction from the south, from the wilderness of Judah, all the way up to the north, to Riblah. So when they see destruction from north to south, they will finally get the message that I am the Lord. And this is exactly the same message that Amos had in Amos 6:14. He said, behold, I am going to raise up a nation against you, O house of Israel, declares the Lord God of hosts, and they will afflict you from the entrance of Hamath, and Hamath is the region of Riblah, where Riblah is located, to the brook of the Arabah, and of course the Arabah is south in the wilderness of Judah. So from north to south, Israel would feel destruction and dispersion and realize that Yahweh is God. Well, this brings us now to the new material. We're now entering chapter 7. We'll begin chapter 7 in verse 1 with the message that the end of Judah has come. Now, the false prophets are saying, no way, this is not going to happen. And so they're opposing Jeremiah and our friend Ezekiel. Jeremiah is in Jerusalem prophesying while Ezekiel is in Babylon prophesying. And so those who are influenced by the false prophets who live in the exile in Babylon are also coming against Ezekiel. All right, we begin in verse 1 with the word of the Lord. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, and again, this is God's words, not Ezekiel's words. And he proclaims an end upon the land in verse 2. And you, son of man, thus says the Lord God to the land of Israel, the end is coming on the four corners of the land. And again, this is spoken to the frail son of man, Ezekiel. He's only the vehicle for God's word. And the end has come is very, very emphatic. It's repeated, an end, the end has come. And Amos made a very, very similar statement in Amos 8:2. He said, "What do you see, Amos?" And I said, "A basket of summer fruit." Then the Lord said to me, "The end has come for my people Israel. I will spare them no longer." So these prophets were being very, very consistent with one another. Of course, they're getting the same revelation from the same God, so that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? And now this is going to come upon the four corners of the land. In other words, the end will involve all of the land. Not an acre of the land will escape this judgment. And the basis of judgment is in verse 3. "Now the end is upon you, and I will send my anger against you. I will judge you according to your ways and bring all your abominations upon you." So the basis for judgment, the cause for the judgment, are two reasons. God's anger against their ways. This is their behavior, their sinful actions, their unrighteous behavior. And he's going to bring upon them all their abominations. That is their idolatry. So their behavior on a social level, person to person, and then their worship of idols, their relationship with God. All those relationships were in very bad shape. So this judgment will come without mercy, we learn in verse 4. "For my eye will have no pity on you, nor will I spare you, but I will bring your ways upon you, and your abominations will be among you, and you will know, then you will know that I am the Lord." So what God will not do negatively, he's not going to spare them. He's going to give them no mercy. So there's going to be no mercy at all. That's the negative side. The positive side, what God will do, he'll bring your ways upon you. They'll receive a just punishment. And their abominations will be very, very, very obvious. You know, they'll see all the idol worship that's been going on, and they will know why the judgment calls. It's very obvious idol worship. And the result, this is God's intended result, they will know that I am the Lord. This is the same refrain over and over and over again. They will finally recognize who God is. So the judgment is without mercy in verse 4, and then as we move into verses 5 through 9, we learn about the doom to come. The doom to come. We start with the disaster in verse 5. "Thus says the Lord God, a disaster, unique disaster. Behold, it is coming." Now the King James Version says evil, but this is not evil in the sense of moral wrong. This is evil in the sense of disaster or calamity, and as the NASB here has translated the term. However, this will be a very unique disaster, and it's repeated in verse 7-6. "An end is coming. The end has come. It is awakened against you. Behold, it has come." So the idea is repeated here again, over and over again, for emphasis. You think Judah and Jerusalem would get the message, but we're pretty stubborn people. Pretty hard for us to get the message. All right. And so the doom is then repeated in verse 7. "Your doom has come to you, O inhabitant of the land. The time has come. The day is near. Tumult rather than joyful shouting on the mountains." So this is the result. This doom is going to come upon the inhabitants of the land, the Jewish people. And again, it's repeated in staccato statements for emphasis. The time has come. The day is near. It is a day of tumult. It's not a day of joyful shouting upon the mountains. So the result will be the end of the joyful feasts on the high places that accompanied their idolatry. That will be gone. Again, the basis of the judgment in verse 8. "Now I will surely pour out my wrath on you and spend my anger against you and judge you according to your ways and bring on you all your abominations." So again, as in verse 3, he's going to judge them according to their ways, their behavior, their outer activities, and according to their abominations, their false worship of idols. And again in verse 9, he repeats that judgment is without mercy. My eye will show no pity, nor will I spare. I will repay you according to your ways while your abominations are in your midst. Then you will know that I, the Lord, do the smiting. So again, negatively, there's going to be no mercy. And positively, they're going to reap what they sow from their ways and their abominations, from their actions and their idolatry. They will reap what they have sown. But now we come to one more result, and it's the same as before, but it has a little bit of a twist to it. The result, you'll know that I, the Lord, do smite, or do the smiting. Well, this term, the Lord smites, the Lord who smites in the Hebrew is Yahweh Makeh, and literally it means the Lord who smites. The Hebrew is one of the names of God. This is one of his names. It's a compound name of God. And by the way, the same word is used to describe Judah Maccabee, Makeh, to strike with a hammer. So God is the one who strikes. And then, again, it's reiterated that the time has come in verses 10 through 13. This time, two rods are prominent here. First of all, the rod of pride in verse 10. Behold the day, behold it is coming. Your doom has come forth. The rod has budded. Arrogance has blossomed. And so the rod has blossomed. The picture is of a budding rod, but it is not budding with fruit or flowers. It's budding with arrogance. Here's the rod that has budded. Arrogance has blossomed. The fruit is arrogance, not apples or pears or peaches or anything like that. Arrogance. And then pride has budded. Now this reference to arrogance is to Israel. This is the sin. This is a sin, arrogance against the Lord, thinking they can do whatever they wished, considering themselves more important than the Lord and his wishes. All right, now we come to chapter 7 and verse 11, and we learn the name of another rod, the rod of wickedness. Violence has grown into a rod of wickedness. None of them shall remain, none of their people, none of their wealth, nor anything eminent among them. So again, we have this rod, it's born arrogance, and now it bears violence. Violence has risen up on the rod of wickedness. And the point here is that sin is just getting worse and worse. And this is exactly what James says in James 1:15. But when lust has conceived, there's the beginning of sin. The picture here is a human baby being born. So conception's the first step. And now the conception here, of course, occurs in a person's mind. He thinks about the lust. It's conceived. Then second step, it gives birth to sin. And now lust and that sin which has been conceived internally reveals itself externally, just as a baby is born now into the world. So the sin begins to work itself out in the world, in the actions of the person. And when the sin is accomplished, fully completed, fully formed, then sin has to mature. It gets worse and worse until it gets to its height, just as a baby gets more and more mature. And once it gets fully formed, fully mature, then it brings forth death. Then sin creates death. And all people have to die as well, according to this little, following the pattern of human birth, life, and death here. So the sin gets worse to worse. So the results for Israel, none of them shall remain. That's the population, the people. They will experience death. Nor their multitude, that's their family. They'll experience death. Nor their wealth, that's their property, it'll be destroyed. Neither shall there be eminency, or perhaps it could be rendered wailing upon them. If the better term is eminency, that means they'll have no status. They'll all be reduced to refugee slaves. If wailing is the better rendering, then none are going to be around to mourn the dead. They've all been exiled. As we come to verse 12, the picture of a buyer comes into view. The time has come. The day has arrived. Let not the buyer rejoice, nor the seller mourn, for wrath is against all their multitude. So this is judgment upon the economic system. There will be no more delay. God's patience is exhausted. And the picture here is of haggling. People haggling in a marketplace, you know, a typical Middle Eastern shuk. And the buyer rejoices. He thinks he's found a good deal. And the seller is mourning. He's pretending to be selling at a loss. Oh, you've got such a good deal out of me. And the point here is that this is not the time to be focused on your day-to-day activities, buying and selling. For the reason, wrath is about to come on all the multitude. Completion of judgment is hanging over your head. Now, there's an application to us as well in Matthew 24:37-42, dealing with the rapture. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For in those days, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark. And the same is going on in Jerusalem. They're eating and drinking and giving in marriage until the Babylonians come into the city. And what about us today? We're eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage till the rapture occurs. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. And so the coming of the Son of Man will be. And so that's the judgment in Noah's day. There'll be a judgment in Ezekiel's day upon Jerusalem. And there'll be a judgment in our day. When we are raptured shortly after that time, the tribulation judgments will fall upon earth. And now the rapture is described. Then there will be two men in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding in the mill. One will be taken and one will be left. Therefore, be on the alert. Don't be focused on your daily, everyday activities, eating, drinking, marriage, giving in marriage, and all that stuff. Be on the alert, for you don't know the day your Lord is coming. We don't know when the rapture is going to happen. So that's a good application to us. Don't get caught up in all the trivial things of daily life. Stay on the alert. Well, now as we come to verse 13, the seller comes into focus. Indeed, the seller will not regain what he sold as long as they both live. For the vision regarding all their multitude will not be averted, nor will any of them maintain his life by his iniquity. And so the reference here is to the year of Jubilee. Now you may be asking, what is the year of Jubilee? Here's a quick explanation. The Yovel, the year of Jubilee. The year of Jubilee is the Sabbath rest at the end of seven sabbatical annual cycles, every 49 or 50 years. Leviticus 25, verse 8. During this year, economic debts were to be forgiven, the land restored to families who sold in order to repay debt, and slaves sold to repay debt were to be liberated. So the seller will not see his land restored in the year of Jubilee, because he will be in captivity. He'll be in exile. Now in verse 13 here, the emphasis is on the completeness of their judgment. It's on the whole multitude, on all their multitude. And so for those who die, the judgment is permanent. And for the multitude who is caught up into it, they will be exiled. And as we get to verses 14 through 22, the wrath of God and the sword of God comes into view. The wrath in verse 14. They have blown the trumpet and made everything ready, but no one is going to battle, for my wrath is against all their multitude. Okay, so they've blown the trumpet. That's a warning of the approaching enemy. It's a call for the army to attack. Defend yourselves. Get ready. Go to the wall. Now, the Hebrew only says, sound the blast of a wind instrument. The type of instrument is not mentioned here. It could be the shofar. So this is the ram's horn wind instrument, or it could be the silver trumpets, the hatzotzarot that was also used in the temple. Anyway, some kind of a trumpet blast is going to be sounded, and the weapons are all mobilized, but nobody goes out to battle. Why? Because God's wrath is on the multitude. They understand it's useless to resist the attacking army, and so there's cowardly fear on the walls of Jerusalem as they view the huge and ferocious Babylonian army. And then the sword is explained in verse 15. The sword is outside, and the plague and the famine are within. He who is in the field will die by the sword. Famine and plague will consume those in the city. So the sword without is the besieging army of Babylon. The pestilence and famine within is inside the city walls of Jerusalem. He that's in the field will die by the sword, will be killed by the Babylonian army. And he that's in the city will die by hunger and disease. Not a pretty picture. But in verse 16, we learn there will be a surviving remnant. Verse 16. Even then their survivors escape. They will be on the mountain like doves of the valleys, all of them mourning each over his own iniquity. So there's going to be some that escape, but they are compared to doves on the mountains, all of them moaning. Well, here's a picture of a mourning dove. Notice M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, a dove that makes moaning sounds of distress and grief. And so the references to the fact that the idols in which they trusted were useless. And so they're mourning the fact that they got no help from their silver and gold and wood and stone. Now the effect on the people is in verses 17 through 19, and that impact of the judgment will have three effects. We begin in verse 17. All hands will hang limp, and all knees will become like water. So cowardice and defeat will overcome the population. Cowardice and defeat. And then in verse 18, mourning, they will gird themselves with sackcloth, and shuddering will overwhelm them, and shame will be on all faces, and baldness on all their heads. So they'll gird themselves with sackcloth. Now here's an illustration of a sackcloth. A sackcloth is a very rough cloth made from animal hair, usually that of a goat or a camel. It's a symbol of an expression of mourning, and sometimes it's worn with ashes poured upon the head. Symbols of mourning and defeat and devastation, grief. Sackcloth and ashes. So they can see foresee the devastation that's coming upon them as they look from the city walls. Now, effect number three is the effect upon the gold and the silver in verse 19. And they will fling their silver into the streets, and their gold will become an abhorrent thing. Their silver and their gold will not be able to deliver them in the day of the wrath, in the day of the wrath of the Lord. They cannot satisfy their appetite, nor can they fill their stomachs, for their iniquity has become an occasion of stumbling. So they're going to throw their silver into the streets, and they're going to discard their gold. It's an unclean thing. Now, this term unclean is a technical term for a certain kind of impurity. Female impurity in Leviticus 20:18. That was considered exceptional uncleanness, extreme impurity. Now why? Why are they going to do these actions? Because their silver and their gold is not going to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord. And because it has been a stumbling block to their iniquity, that's because the silver and gold was used to make the little household idols. And so the point is the silver and gold will neither buy them food nor deliverance. And so it's thrown into the streets as though it was extremely impure. And there's a good principle here. We shouldn't put our trust in wealth and in riches. A lot of people do, but the Proverbs warn us, he who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like a green leaf. And then Paul in 1 Timothy 6:17 states, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. So there's a warning to us as well. Don't get arrogant. Don't think that your riches are going to buy your way out of any situation that you find yourself in. You can lose them at the snap of a finger. All right, so we've looked at the effect on the people. Now we looked at the effects on the temple in verses 20 through 22. What the temple has become is the first subject. They transformed the beauty of his ornaments into pride, and they made the images of their abominations and their detestable things with it. Therefore, I will make it an abhorrent thing to them. So what did God do? He had the temple built. And it's described here as his ornaments, the beauty of his ornaments. God considered Solomon's temple like a beautiful jewel, like a beautiful, something beautiful you would wear on your clothes or around your neck or on a ring on your finger, a beautiful jewel. But what did Israel do? We made our images, our abominations, our idols, and we took our detestable things into the temple. They set up their abominable idols within the temple and transformed it into something that was ugly. So what did God do? In response to what Israel did, he said he's going to make it, the temple, as an unclean thing. The temple's been defiled. It's now unclean. He will treat it as an unclean thing. And so in verse 21, the temple is to be given up. I will give it into the hands of the foreigners as plunder and of the wicked of the earth as spoil, and they will profane it. So the hands of strangers are going to plunder the gold in the temple, and the wicked of the earth will take it as spoil. It will become the booty of war for the Babylonians, and it will be made, therefore, unholy. It will be profaned in verse 22. I will also turn my face from them, and they will profane my secret place. Then robbers will enter and profane it. Now, the focus here is not the temple in general, but a very, very special room in the temple, God's secret place. He's referring here to the Holy of Holies. Now, let's take a look at the temple, and I'll explain all of that to you if you're not familiar with it. This is an overview, a drawing of the Temple of Solomon, and it's thought that it looks something like this. Now, here is a floor plan of Solomon's temple. The artist has drawn the altar here on the north side, and he's drawn the basin of water on the south side. Now, the first most prominent room in the temple was the outer room, the holy place. But God is talking about another room. He's talking about his secret place, the Holy of Holies. This is where the Shekhinah, God, would appear visibly over the Ark of the Covenant, and only the high priest was allowed in there once a year. So as I said here, the Ark of the Covenant was in that secret place, and that's where the Shekhinah would appear between the wings of the cherubim. God would be physically visible, and only the high priest would ever see that in the holy place, in the secret room. Now here's a cutaway of Solomon's temple, and this is the Holy of Holies back here, the secret room. Now this picture is of the outer room, the holy place, the first room, pictured with the 10 tables of showbread and the 10 menorot that are described in Scripture. And before a curtain, you see at the far end of the room, two priests are prostrating themselves in prayer. Well, that is the curtain separating the holy place from the Holy of Holies. They had to go beyond that curtain in order to see the Ark of the Covenant. And again, here's a cross section of Solomon's temple. And again, here's the Holy of Holies, the secret room, a cubicle room at the end of the backside of the temple. And by the way, in this drawing, right in there, on the ground, look on the ground and you'll see a little niche. And that's the niche where the Ark of the Covenant would have been placed. Right in that area. So here's an illustration of the high priest offering the Yom Kippur incense offering on the Day of Atonement in the holy place, the Holy of Holies, I should say, before the Ark of the Covenant. And here is another depiction of the high priest sprinkling the blood of the Day of Atonement in the Holy of Holies. All right, Ezekiel 7:23 now, we come to the indictment. In verse 23, make the chain, for the land is full of bloody crimes, and the city is full of violence. Make the chain. This is a symbol of captivity. This has happened before in 597 with the second deportation, 2 Chronicles 36, 5 and 6. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord God, the Lord his God. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against him and bound him with bronze chains to take him to Babylon. So that's that second deportation, 597 BC. And this is exactly what would happen to the survivors in 586 BC during the third deportation. Jeremiah witnessed that. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord after Nebuzaradan, captain of the bodyguard, had released him from Ramah, when he had taken him bound in chains among all the exiles of Jerusalem and Judah who were being exiled to Babylon. So Jeremiah witnessed this. So why would he put them in chains? Well, the land is full of bloody crimes, all of Judah, and the city is full of violence, all of Jerusalem. And so the temple, which had been viewed as a good luck charm by the citizens of Jerusalem, will be profaned and destroyed, and the people taken into captivity. You know, God said to them in the book of Jeremiah, "You treat my temple like a good luck charm, and I will destroy my temple." You see, it had been profaned in their mind, profaned by their attitudes, profaned by their activities. All right, verse 24, the judgment. "Therefore I will bring the worst of the nations, and they will possess their houses. I will also make the pride of their strong ones cease, and their holy places will be profaned. Therefore, because of what I just said, I'll bring on the worst of the nations." That's the Babylonians. They were ruthless conquerors. And there'll be three results. They'll possess their houses, so the Jewish people will be deported. That's effect number one, result number one. They'll be deported. Other people will live in their houses. Effect number two, I will make the pride of the strong to cease. The Jewish people will be humbled. Number three, the holy place is profaned. Their idol worship will be desecrated. Their idol worship on the hills and the valleys and the watercourses, etc., will be all desecrated. Now, the fourth result in verse 25 is that there'll be a loss of hope. When anguish comes, they will seek peace, but there will be none. So anguish, because they will seek peace with Nebuchadnezzar, but they'll have none. He'll say no. This is the third uprising by you folks. Three strikes and you're out. I'm not extending any more mercy to you. I am going to raise the city and the temple to the ground and deport every one of you. I will not make peace with you. So there's a loss of hope. The fifth result is confusion, starting in verse 26, first part of the verse. Disaster will come upon disaster, and rumor will be added to rumor. So no one's going to know what to believe. No one's not going to know what's going on. And the news will be confusing rumors. The sixth result will be the impotence of the rulers. Now we come to verses 26 and 27. Talking about the prophet. The rulers are going to be impotent, and the first one that's in view is the prophet. The vision of the prophets. This is a statement referring to the false prophets. The false prophets. So there'll be none. You know, Micah has a similar statement. "Thus says the Lord concerning the prophets who lead my people astray." See, they're false prophets. "When they have something to bite with their teeth, they cry peace. But against him who puts nothing in their mouths, they declare holy war." See, that's what's happening to Jeremiah at this time, and also Ezekiel. "Therefore, I will be night for you without vision, and darkness for you without divination. The sun will go down on the prophets, and the day will become dark over them. The seers will be ashamed. The diviners will be embarrassed. Indeed, they will all cover their mouths because there is no answer from God." And so they're all prophesying nothing's going to happen. And when it comes, they will be totally devastated. Now his attention turns to the priest in verses 26 and 27. "But the law will be lost from the priest." So the priest will be unable to explain the law to the people. And the tribe of Levi was to teach the law to the people. And here they're not going to be able to. And this is being denied in Jerusalem as well in Jeremiah 18, 18. "Then they said, come, let us devise plans against Jeremiah. Surely the law is not going to be lost from the priest." See, everybody's denying what Jeremiah and what Ezekiel are saying. And they have opposition opposition against them. And then the elders, and counsel from the elders. So wisdom is going to lead the elders as well, and this is being denied in Jerusalem. Jeremiah had witnessed it. And they said, come, let us devise plans against Jeremiah. Surely the law is not going to be lost to the priest, nor counsel from the sage, nor divine word from the prophet. Come on, let us strike him with our tongue, and let us give no heed to his words. So you can see, you get a picture of the opposition that Jeremiah and Ezekiel are facing from their fellow Jews, from the false prophets. And now the king, in verses 26 and 27. The king will mourn, the prince will be clothed with horror, and the hands of the people of the land will tremble. The king's going to mourn because he receives no advice from his cabinet. And the prince, he's clothed with horror. You know, he's the lower level of leadership, another tier down. But he's horrified at what's going on. And the people, the hands of the people will be troubled when they see the confused, helpless leadership, the king and the prince. Everybody's going to be trembling. No one to guide them. No one to tell them what to do. And in verse 27, God's purpose for all this comes out. According to their conduct, I will deal with them, and by their judgments, I will judge them, and they will know that I am the Lord. So this is the basis for the judgment. They are reaping what they have sown. They're reaping what they have sown. And the result, eventually, they will know that I am the Lord. Eventually, that's what will happen. They'll finally come to realize who God is. But why? Why, we have to ask, why is the discipline so harsh? You know, this destruction of Jerusalem right down to the ground. Well, that's answered in Deuteronomy 9:13. The Lord spoke further to me, saying, I have seen this people, and indeed is a stubborn people. God has to break our stubborn will before we will acknowledge him as God. So this is the end of the first series of prophecies giving during a period of just over a year's time. Now we'll pick up the date as we move now into chapter 8. We're now in chapter 8. We'll begin in chapter 8, verse 1. Now in chapter 8, we look at the departure of the Shekinah glory. This is a second series of prophecies. He's moving away from the destruction of Jerusalem, and he's now looking at the departure of the Shekinah glory. Now, as far as our time frames go, there's a chart of all the time frames of Ezekiel. And we started out in the present time frame, Ezekiel's present, from chapter 1 through chapter 3. Then we jumped into the near future, what will happen to Jerusalem very shortly, in chapters 4 through 7. And now we jump back to Ezekiel's present time, and we see the explanation of the Shekinah glory leaving the temple. So the occasion is in chapter 8, verse 1. It came about in the sixth year, on the fifth day of the sixth month, as I was sitting in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me, that the hand of the Lord fell on me there. So it's in the sixth year, that's 592 BC. This is during the sixth year after the second deportation in 597. This is inclusive reckoning. So after Ezekiel had been taken into Babylon in the second deportation, it's the sixth month, that's August, September, the fifth day, that turns out to be September 17th, 592 BC. Now, what are the ramifications of this date? Well, it is a year and 2 months since the call. The call of Ezekiel was in chapter 1 through 128 through 3:3, the commission through chapter 3 through 320 through 321. That was the commission and call of Ezekiel in July and August of 593 BC. And so the prophecies of 322 through 727 took place over a period of 14 months, And now we're in chapter 8, verse 1. It's September 592 BC, 14 months. So the math goes like this. 1 year, 12 months times 30 days is 360 days, plus 2 months times 30 days. The Jewish month was 30 days long, 60 days. So the total days elapsed are going to be 420 days. So we're now at the last 10 days of the 430 days that he's been lying on his side. He's told to lay on the left side 390 days, then lay on the right side for 40 days. So that's a total of 430 days, 430 years imitating or portraying, I should say, the 430 years of iniquity. And so the days remaining are 10 days. He's to lay on his side for 430 days, and the total days that have lapsed are 420 days. So there's 10 days remaining for him to lay on his right side. Now, the elders of the exile, the elders of the deported community, come to him. And that this shows us that after the first series of messages, he's attracted attention in three ways. Number one, through his silence, except when God spoke, otherwise he was silent. Secondly, through his prophecies of the destruction of Jerusalem. And now, through his symbolic actions. Now, as they come to him, there's an appearance to Ezekiel in verse 2, 8, 2. And then I looked, and behold, a likeness as the appearance of a man. From his loins and downward, there was the appearance of fire. And from his loins and upward, the appearance of brightness, like the appearance of glowing metal. So here we have the appearance of a man-like divine entity. It's not any old run-of-the-mill man, because he's associated with fire. The appearance of his loins downward looks like fire, and from his loins upward is brightness, glowing metal. That's the electrum color that we looked at earlier. So the point of the description is that this is the Shekhinah glory. He's seeing it for a third time, and now especially in the form of a man. The description is the same as in chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, the form of a man, the one on the throne. Now, what do the rabbis think of this? Well, let's take a look at Rashi's commentary. Now, who is Rashi? In case you're not familiar with him, Rashi is Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki. He was a medieval French rabbi and author of a comprehensive commentary on the Talmud and a commentary on the Hebrew Bible. Now, if you go to the Chabad Lubavitch website, and you can see the address there, you can find the complete Jewish Bible with Rashi commentary. And when you go to Ezekiel 8:2, here's what you read. From the appearance of his loins, etc., that's the reference to chapter 8, verse 2, what does Rashi say? It is forbidden to reflect on this verse. Stay away from it. The rabbis didn't like God appearing in the shape of a man. Stay away from it. Don't think about this. Don't meditate on it. If you go to the Art Scroll Tanakh series on Ezekiel, pages 154 through 156 talk about this particular verse as well. And there you read on the Maaseh Merkava, about the Maaseh Merkava, the divine chariot. In this vision, supernatural concepts are described in human terms. As explained in the prefatory remarks, they cannot be understood literally, nor in our spiritual poverty are we equipped even to glimpse at their inner meaning. We can't figure this out. That's the point. We can't figure this out at all. But you know, if you read on, you'll find that the commentary continues on interrupted rather than skipping over this material. They do try to figure it out. All right, the rabbis say that the Jewish community, the rabbis, are enduring spiritual poverty these days. So that's why they're not allowed to meditate on that verse and understand it. But you know, we're very fortunate. We are not in spiritual poverty these days because we have the teaching ministry of the Holy Spirit within our souls. 1 Corinthians 2, 12 and 13. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, so that we may know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak. So the things freely given to us is Ezekiel and visions of Ezekiel. They're freely given to us so we can understand them. Not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. So the Spirit will give us insight. Then Revelation 2:7 and a number of verses in Revelation encourage us to do this same thing. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The Spirit wants to teach the churches. To him who overcomes, I will grant to eat in the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. And there's the message. And then in Revelation 2:11, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And here's the message. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death. And then in verse 29, the same thing. Let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And we need to do the same thing today. We need to study the Bible reverently and meditate on it and study it closely and deeply so we can find out what it all means, because God has promised to reveal it to us through His Spirit. All right, now the prophet is transported in verse 3. He stretched out the form of a hand and caught me by a lock of my head. And the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me into the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the entrance of the north gate of the inner court, where the seat of the idol of jealousy, which provokes the jealousy, was located. So he put forth the form of a hand. So here's a human description of in the Shekhinah, a glowing hand, an electrum-colored hand, glowing. And he took me by the lock of his head. That's the only time in Scripture you read about something like this. And the rabbis think it's a symbol of God's displeasure with Israel, dragged off to exile like a master dragging a slave to prison by the hair on his head. But that word lock is the word betzitzit, and that's normally used of the fringes of the corners of a garment in chapter 15, verses 38 and 39 of Numbers. Numbers 15, 38 and 39. Speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they shall make for themselves tassels, tzitzit, on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they shall put on the tassel of each corner a cord of blue. It shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them and not follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you played the harlot. So here's a prayer shawl, a modern prayer shawl. Now in Ezekiel's day, the shawl was just a shawl for keeping the weather, the sun, the rain, and everything off you. It was just a shawl to wear outside. But it had ceremonial tzitzit, fringes attached to it. And here you can see the tzitzit. These are the ones that count. The other fringes along the edge of the shawl are just decorative. Now here's a close-up of a white tzitzit. And you can see the traditional tying pattern. The traditional tying pattern consists of two knots and then seven coils, and then two knots and eight coils, and then two knots and 11 coils, and two knots and 13 coils, and two knots. Now why? Why do we have this ritual tying pattern? Well, coils 7 and 8, the numbers 7 and 8 equals 15, and that's equal to the letters Yod and He, the first two letters of the name of God. And then 11 coils, the 11 is equivalent to the Vav and Hey, the last two letters of the name of God. And the last coils, so those coils, 7, 8, and 11 coils, are equivalent to Yahweh, the name of God. And then the last 13 coils, 13 is equivalent to the Hebrew word Echad, Aleph, Chet, Dalet, which means one. And so to look in the tzitzit is to remember and know that God is one. So that's a nice little reminder, a nice little tradition there to help us remember about God as one. Now, here you can see tzitzit with the biblical cord of blue. You notice the previous one was only white. That's because the snail that provided the blue color, the techelet, disappeared from Israel. So the rabbis didn't want to put just any shade of blue on the tzitzit. So they decided that the tzitzit should just be white. But now that snail is back, and now we can produce that color blue, and so you're beginning to see tzitzit with the color blue, a strand of blue throughout the tzitzit, as is required in Numbers 15:38. And so here are men in their tallit, their prayer shawls, praying at the Western Wall. And here there's another type of tallit that the Orthodox wear. It's called the tallit katan, a small tallit with fringes. And you can see the tzitzit hanging down here because the tallit katan is worn underneath the shirt. That way it can be worn 24/7. Here's your tallit katan with fringes, just a small little tiny prayer shawl worn under the clothes. And then here is a summary of both kinds of tali with fringes from the book To Be a Jew by Rabbi Chaim Halevi Donin, which is a fine book to purchase if you want to increase your knowledge of Judaism. All right, so much for the tzitzit. Here, however, Ezekiel is lifted up apparently by his payas, by the earlocks, the hair coming down on the side of his head here. And here some ultra-Orthodox men with their payas, their forelocks that are not trimmed. So apparently Ezekiel was wearing his hair somewhere like that. And so he's lifted up in a vision. This is a vision. This is not a literal transportation. And he finds himself dangling between heaven and earth. I kind of thought that was kind of clever, humorous. Because if you go to Israel today, you can also dangle between heaven and earth, but it will be by more conventional means. Here is one of the planes that took us on one of our tours of Israel. And here we are, dangling between heaven and earth, overflying modern Tel Aviv, heading for Ben-Gurion Airport. This is modern Tel Aviv in Israel, not Ezekiel's Tel Aviv in Babylonia. And so the journey. Here is Ezekiel's journey. Here is Jerusalem on the west side of the Middle East. And here is Babylon on the east side. And the city of Babylon, or I should say the country of Babylonia, and within it, the city of Babylon. And just south of Babylon, Ezekiel's Tel Aviv. And so he's transported in a vision across the peninsula, across the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, to Jerusalem and the temple. And so it says here that he brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem. That'd be a lot quicker and cheaper than El Al flying you to Jerusalem. And again, this is visions of God. It's not a literal transportation. It's a vision. He still has to lie on his right side another 10 days in Babylonian Tel Aviv. He's still lying on his side, so he is not taken there. The return trip will be mentioned in chapter 11, verse 24. Now, the specific location, he's at the door of the gate of the inner court, which looks toward the north. So he was in the outer court in front of the northeast gate that led to the inner court. Now, here's a drawing of Solomon's temple, and you can see the gate of the altar. That's the gate he's talking about. This is the inner court up on the platform there. That's the inner court. And the outer court is outside of the platform, the level platform there. And so the temple is facing east, so you see my E for east on the left side. This would make this the north side, and then the west side, and the south side. And so here is Ezekiel on the northeast corner of the temple. Now this is from a different view, from the southwest corner. Here is the temple facing east. That E stands for facing east. And so this is the north, this is the west, this is the south. And so Ezekiel is near here in the outer court, close to the inner court, standing by the gate. Now, what has he found there? He finds the seat of the image of jealousy, perhaps a statue of Asherah. And this could have been, this idea could have been started very easily by King Manasseh in 2 Kings 21:7. Then he, King Manasseh, sent the carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of which the Lord said to David and his son Solomon, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. And here is a possible Asherah statue. This is from the Eretz Israel Museum in Tel Aviv. So apparently there's some kind of an idol in the court of the Lord. And it provokes jealousy. Idolatry provokes God to jealousy. For example, Exodus 20, verses 4 through 6. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water underneath the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. And Ezekiel also mentions this jealousy in Ezekiel 16:42 and Ezekiel 36:6. We'll get to that in a while. Now, we normally think of jealousy in a negative sense, but the term really has three senses. Number one, envy, which is a negative sense. That's the bad sense. But then there's zeal, and zeal can be both good and bad. You know, enthusiasm can be both good and bad. And jealousy, and that can be both good and bad. Now, in the good sense, this is jealousy that claims the right of possession. You see, Israel is the wife of the Lord, and he claims exclusive right to his wife. So this image outrages his authority, and this provokes him to vindicate his exclusive rights. He's jealous. So worship of the other gods is spiritual adultery, and he intends to reclaim his rightful possession, his wife. And so this is good jealousy. He's been pushed aside. Now, as we get to verse 4, we see the Shekhinah again. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the appearance which I saw on the plain. So in the general location of the gate, the Shekhinah appears. So here's Ezekiel in this somewhere in this area, and so the Shekhinah is near him as well. And it's the same as he saw on the plain. Again, here is Ezekiel, and then the Shekhinah is close by as well. And what he sees is the divine chariot again, according to the appearance which I saw on the plain. And now we come to the abomination of desolation in verses 5 through 18. Ezekiel is now shown various abominations so that he will understand why the Shekinah glory must depart from Israel. The glory of God has indwelt the glory of the Holy of Holies for some 850 years. The glory of God has been in the Holy of Holies for 850 years, first in the tabernacle, then in Solomon's temple. But now the Shekinah glory is going to leave. So the sin is in verse 5. Then he said to me, Son of man, raise your eyes now toward the north. So I raised my eyes toward the north, and behold, to the north of the altar, gate, was this idol of jealousy at the entrance. So lift up your eyes toward the north. So apparently he's facing south. He obeys by lifting his eyes toward the north. He turns around, and what does he see? Northward of the gate of the altar. And by the way, it's called the gate of the altar because the animals were sacrificed on the north side of the altar in Leviticus 1:11. So here's the gate of the altar. And the image of jealousy is at the entrance. It's standing there near the gate of the altar. And this would put it in the outer court. And here's some more Astarte images, or three pictures of an Astarte image. This might have been the type of image placed there. But the problem is this. Everyone entering with proper animals, everyone bringing proper sacrificial animals would have to pass by this image. They would have to pass by this image to go through the gate. And the implication would be that they were worshiping an idol and then sacrificing their sacrifice to the idol. So the declaration comes in verse 6. Then he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations which the house of Israel are committing here so that I would be far from my sanctuary? In other words, you see what they're doing, Ezekiel? These great abominations? And this is forcing me away from my sanctuary? And this is the purpose of the vision, to show why the Shekhinah must depart from the temple. It's incredibly unclean. And then there's a transition. But yet you will see still greater abominations. There's more to come. And so another form of idolatry is found in the worship of Egyptian gods in chapter 8, verses 7 through 13. So the transition again. He brought me to the entrance of the court, and when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. And so he's brought close to the door. Apparently he moves closer to the gate of the altar, and he sees some kind of a hole in the wall. And so he's commanded to dig in verse 8. He said to me, Son of man, now dig through the wall. So I dug through the wall, and behold, an entrance. Now remember, this is not literal. You can't dig through stone. This is the vision. Literally, he's laying on his side in Tel Aviv, and he's been transported in a vision to Jerusalem, and so this is happening in a vision. And so a door is exposed in the vision, And then there's a command in verse 9. He said to me, go in and see the wicked abominations they are committing there. So he's to look and see what's happening inside. And what does he see? Idolatry. And so I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping things and beasts and detestable things with all the idols of the house of Israel were carved on the wall all around. So he goes in and sees, and what does he see? He sees Egyptian deities, perhaps Osiris. Now the Egyptians worshipped 120 gods. They worshipped 120 gods, including every form of creeping things. They had lice gods and frog gods and fly gods and abominable beasts. And all this was forbidden in Leviticus chapter 11, 47 verses forbidding this. Now here's some pictures. Here's some Egyptian hieroglyphics carved on the wall. And this is what the worshipers were were imitating in the holy place, in the temple, carving images on the walls. Here's another wall carving. This is the royal Egyptian family worshiping the sun god. Here is Pharaoh Akhenaten with one of his children. And this is Nefertiti, Queen Nefertiti, with one of her children. And pouring his rays upon them is the sun god Aten. Worshiping Aten, the sun god. They also worshipped Hathor. Hathor was the mother goddess in Egypt. In Egyptian mythology, I should read. Hathor can be readily identified by her cow ears and typical headdress with its outward curl at the neck. As a winged cow, she gave birth to the universe. She materialized at each child's birth and foretold its destiny. She suckled pharaohs. She was queen of the underworld. That was one of their gods. Here's Thoth, the god of writing and science, an Egyptian god, an idol. Here's the Egyptian god Horus, the god of the sky. And this is the Apis bull, very important god to the Egyptians. It's thought that it was an Apis bull that Israel worshipped when they made the golden calf. And this is the god Amun as a ram, worshipping a ram. Now all these idols of the house of Israel are portrayed on the walls round about. And again, God uses the word pellets of dung. All these pellets of dung are portrayed on the walls round about. It's pretty disgusting from God's perspective. He is deeply offended by all this. Well, I think I'm about out of time here. So we're going to pick this up next session with the worshipers. We've seen what they worship, and now we'll see who they are.